the chance to commit more crimes.
Various speakers at the seminar agreed that the root cause of the conflict in Gaza is the illegal Israeli occupation of Palestinian lands for over 70 years. So, the Hamas attack didn't happen in a vacuum, but it was the result of years of subjugation and oppression of Palestinians by the Israelis. They said the Israeli regime continuously spreads lies and propaganda about the origins of its existence and also highlight anti-Semitism to justify its war crimes. The participants at the seminar described journalists as the eye of the public and said they must report accurately and comprehensively during conflict and war situations. They called on international organizations and civil society groups to protect journalists who report the truth. Danjum Abdullahi, Kaduna.
At Sankofa, a black-owned bookstore less than 4 kilometers from the U.S.'s Congressional Center of Power. An historic lesson on political control and oppression learned beyond books.
We understand that this is all connected to colonialism. You know, here we are standing on stolen land right now on a settler colony called America, and our Palestinian brothers and sisters are struggling to defend their land from a settler, you know, colonial, Zionist state called Israel.
Because what's happening in Gaza right now is also an attack on Christianity. Let's be very, very clear.
Activist groups led by Black Americans spoke out against the deaths of thousands of people in Gaza, highlighting historic affiliations between Palestinians and members of the African diaspora, comparisons of a tormented history of colonial enslavement and brutality.
So we say free, free Palestine, long live Palestine, death to colonialism in any of its iterations.
Black writers and civil rights leaders possess a decades-old history of relating to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, comparing the resistance against Zionism to the Black struggle for independence against colonialism and apartheid.
The Zionists have laid claim to the land, and their process of laying claim is to wipe out all of the indigenous population and claim everything for themselves rather than living in peace.
Activists assert that Blacktivism, a Black resistance repudiation of colonialism, has a legacy with Palestinians. Interwoven, the patterns of subjugation and exploitation under political tyranny.
This is the 15th year for the Black People's March on the White House to speak out against injustices. It has also formed affiliations with other groups to condemn colonialism, much of it against marginalized populations.
You're seeing the state of Israel, how it's working now to push the Palestinian people out and replace them. Look at what's happening in Washington, D.C. What you have in Palestine is nothing but armed gentrification.
These activists plan to march with Palestinian sympathizers in upcoming days while interrogating how to reach the elusive goal of equity and peace. Colin Campbell, Washington.
In the limelight.
The brutal reality of daily life for Gaza's residents are these: little food, no water, no medicines, anguished parents struggle to meet their children's needs while their own bodies weaken. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, 6 days after she gave birth to her baby, Salma Radi was forced to evacuate her home in the northern Gaza Strip to flee the relentless bombing of the Zionist regime and seek refuge in the central Gaza Strip, where she and her husband are now staying in a small apartment with 43 other people. Displaced, scared, and in bad health, Radi is struggling to take care of the baby Omar. Ravi, 28, told the Middle East Eye, "I was still bleeding badly after having given birth when we had to evacuate our home, leaving everything behind. I carried my son and one bag and ran with my husband in the dark for around 1 hour until we found a taxi. Before dawn, at 4 a.m. that day, the couple had received a recorded phone message from the Zionist regime's military ordering them to evacuate ahead of the imminent bombing on the Gaza City." Radi said, "We started running around the house, not knowing what to do. We took our official papers and money and left everything else behind. The piles of canned food we had bought at the beginning of the war, our clothes, the beautiful bedroom, and the things we had bought for Omar over the past year." Ravi had not brought milk for her son since she was still nursing, but a few days after they were displaced, her son stopped breastfeeding. She said, "He started crying hysterically whenever I tried to breastfeed him. He spat out the milk and refused to have it. He remained about a whole day without food. I didn't know what to do or why he was refusing to breastfeed." After many phone call attempts on the severely damaged communication networks, Radi finally managed to reach her doctor. She was told that anxiety and fear changed the taste and texture of breast milk, and that is why her baby has been refusing it. She said, "I also do not eat well and thus cannot produce enough milk. Honestly, in the past years, I was yearning to have a child. I cried and prayed day and night so that God would grant me a baby, but now I regret all of it. I regret having a baby and I feel guilty for bringing him to this world where he's already suffering, and I will continue to suffer for the rest of his life as long as he is a Palestinian. I do not say this to my husband, but I truly regret all the days when I prayed to have a child." When the Zionist regime launched its war on the Gaza Strip on October 7th, Razi's husband, Mahmoud, rushed to the supermarket to stock up on food, bread, drinking water and medicine. But when they had to flee their home, they did not manage to take any of it with them. Today, Radi and her husband are unable to go back home to get the much-needed food they had bought after the Zionist regime cut off the northern Gaza Strip and the Gaza City from the central and southern areas by bombing the roads linking them. She said, "The only way left for us to go home now is the Al-Rashid Street on the coastal road, but whoever drives there gets targeted by the Zionist regime gunboats and tanks." Recently, the Zionist regime forces targeted a group of internally displaced persons who were driving on Al-Rashid Street on their way to the southern Gaza Strip, which the Israeli military had warned people to move to for their safety. At least 8 people, including children, were killed. A few hours later, a group of ambulances transferring a number of wounded people to the Rafah border in the south were also targeted on the same street. Although the Palestinian Health Ministry had coordinated with the Red Cross before transferring them. An ambulance driver was wounded, and the ambulances returned to Al-Shifa Hospital in the Gaza City. At least 9,448 people have been killed, including 3,900 children and 2,500 women, since the Zionist regime started its most aggressive bombing campaign in Gaza on October 7. Middle East Monitor also wrote, "With the Zionist regime cutting off water and food supplies to Gaza, owners of grocery markets say they will not be able to restock the emptying shelves until the Zionist regime lifts its siege of the already blockaded enclave. in Nusayrat refugee camp, one of the most densely populated areas in the central Gaza Strip. Tens of thousands of residents have sought refuge from the bombing in Gaza City and the northern Gaza Strips. With few markets and bakeries still open, residents and displaced people struggle to get food and bread.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Figures reported by the charity organization Save the Children shows the number of children killed in the Gaza Strip as a result of Israel's ongoing aggression has exceeded annual figures related to global conflicts over the past 4 years. The international NGO says that Israel's brutal military attack against Gaza, which began on October 7 in response to an operation by the Palestinian resistance group Hamas, has so far killed more than the annual number of children killed in armed conflicts globally in each of the past 4 years. According to multiple reports, including the Palestinian Health Ministry and the Defense for Children International, DCI, one child is being killed in Gaza every 10 minutes. EuroMed Human Rights Monitor said in a press release on October 18 that since the launch of the indiscriminate bombing crusade against Gaza, an average of 100 children have been killed daily. Hundreds of children are still trapped under the rubble of residential buildings targeted during Israel's strikes on Gaza, and they have not been rescued yet, which implies the actual death toll could be higher. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said in a statement that at least 1,000 children are missing under the rubble in Gaza. The ongoing siege and the relentless bombardment are impeding search and rescue operations.
Gaza has become a graveyard for children. It's a living hell for everyone else. And yet the threats to children go beyond bombs and mortars. And I want to speak briefly now on two of those, water and trauma. The more than 1 million children of Gaza have a critical water crisis. Gaza's water production now, its capacity is at 5% of its daily output. So child deaths to dehydration, particularly infant deaths to dehydration, are a growing threat.
The UN Committee on the Rights of the Child has also issued a statement saying grave human rights violations against children are mounting by the minute in the Gaza Strip. The statement says armed conflict harms children first and foremost and has lifelong effects on their physical and mental health, their development, and ultimately the enjoyment of all their rights. Children are also harmed when they survive, but lose parents and other family members and friends, and also witness catastrophic events. The committee has also called for an end to the devastating harm that's being leveled on children's lives in the occupied Palestinian territory. It has also called on all parties to protect all children and to provide all the necessary medical and protective support, including psychological support, to begin the long process of overcoming the consequences of these grave violations.
Then, of course, we have the trauma. When finally the fighting stops, the cost to children and their communities is going to be borne out for generations to come. Before this latest escalation, before it, more than 800,000 children in Gaza, that's three quarters of the entire child population of Gaza, were identified as needing mental health and psychological support. Again, that's before this latest nightmare.
In a desperate move, Palestinian children and their parents have started writing their names on their bodies in black ink so that they can be identified in hospitals if they are killed or injured in Israeli strikes. Children pulled from the wreckage of buildings are sometimes unrecognizable due to grave injuries. Heartbreaking photos of children lying on steel trays inside Gaza hospital morgues with their sleeves or legs of trousers pushed up to reveal their names have been going viral on social media. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said in a report last Tuesday that almost every child in Gaza has been exposed to deeply distressing events and trauma.
We're talking about children witnessing their parents, their families, their sisters and brothers being killed in front of them, their houses, their communities disappearing in a split second. This has a big toll on their emotional, psychological, and mental health.
The report highlighted that children are experiencing widespread destruction, relentless attacks, displacement, and severe shortages of essential necessities like food, water, and medicine. The report added that without stable electricity and fuel supplies, essential facilities like hospitals, desalination plants, and water pumping stations cannot work properly.
It's interesting, Amy, we have a formula at the United Nations that is applied to virtually every other conflict situation. But when it comes to the situation in Israel and Palestine, there's a different set of rules, apparently. And that's, I think, a big source of my frustration. Where is the transitional justice process? Where is the UN protection force to protect all civilians? Where is the tribunal for accountability? Where is the action on the part of the Security Council, the only mechanism in the United Nations that has enforcement to ensure protection in the occupied territories?
Gaza Strip skyline. Israel's bombing campaign continues. An apocalyptic scene. It appears Israel is using the banned white phosphorus bombs again. Bombs which burns the skin down to the bone. The death toll continues to mount, like at the Al-Maghazi camp. 51 Palestinians murdered. Another massacre on top of the others. Genocide on speed. The cries over the loss of a beloved one, which is why people are angry worldwide. But the biggest rally for Palestinians ever to have taken place in Washington, D.C. The war is coming at a cost for Israel. Diplomatically, Bolivia cut off relations with Israel, with Turkey, Colombia, Chad, and Honduras recalling their ambassadors. Persian Gulf Arab leaders meeting with the U.S. Secretary of State. They all called for a ceasefire, but Blinken did not blink. No to a ceasefire, and on a humanitarian pause, a big maybe.
It's our view that a ceasefire now would simply leave Hamas in place.
Yet Blinken had only echoed Netanyahu's statements on a ceasefire.
Calls for a ceasefire are calls for Israel to surrender to Hamas.
David Petraeus, the retired general of the U.S. Army, responsible in part for his failure in Afghanistan and also in Iraq, in a leaked audio file, encouraged and approved Israel's carnage in Gaza.
I see no alternative to the destruction of Hamas, and I use that term specifically because, as Aviv knows, there's a military doctrinal term. It's a gradation. You know, you can disrupt, you can deny, you can defeat, you can destroy.
But he must not have been prepared for what an Israeli minister said when asked whether an atomic bomb should be dropped on the Gaza Strip. Amihai Eliyahu said this is one of the possibilities. Let's not forget, the Gaza Strip has already been hit by an atomic bomb. But not at once. Slowly, 25,000 tons dropped on the Strip so far. The resistance fighters slammed these comments as reflective of the evil and terrorist nature of the regime, while they fought street battles against the Israeli regime forces. Israel has suffered casualties as a result. The tide may be turning, with costs mounting for the U.S. and Israel. For Israel, the worldwide anti-Israel protests have shattered its image. These protests have also worked against the U.S.
It's definitely ceasefire. People are getting killed every minute.
In the U.S., there are worries about the aftermath of the war. It's time for Israel's friends to recognize that the current operational approach is causing an unacceptable level of civilian harm and does not appear likely to achieve the goal of permanently ending the threat from Hamas, is what this high-ranking senator said. In other words, the U.S. is at the phase of the war where people are starting to worry about how they will look when this is over. And they are worried about votes also, as cynical as that sounds. Muslim and Arab American groups have threatened to not vote for Biden in 2024. This includes Democratic Party leaders from contested states that can decide elections, such as Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. That, combined with the sanctioning of Israeli products, which has also gained traction, especially amongst the Generation Zs in the U.S., and not just in the U.S., but around the world.
Since October the 7th, Israel has launched a relentless bombing campaign against the people of Gaza. The bombardments have claimed the lives of thousands of innocent Palestinians, most of them women and children. Israel's genocidal war on the people of Palestine has sparked mass rallies across the world. Journalists, activists, and even athletes have joined the growing calls to put an end to the carnage. But most of these voices are being suppressed due to the pressure by Israel and Zionist lobbies. Reports have been circulating at an alarming pace about activists being sacked from their positions, journalists being relieved of their duties, and even athletes being stripped of their contracts. The editor-in-chief of an academic journal said that he was fired from his job after sharing an article about people dying in Gaza. Michael Eisen, a geneticist at the University of California, Berkeley, and the editor of the scientific journal eLife, tweeted to say that he had been informed that he is being replaced as the publication's editor. Egyptian TikToker Karim Kabani said he had been sacked from his job in France because he made three videos on TikTok in support of the people of Palestine. Jackson Frank, who was recently appointed as the Sixers beat writer for Philly Voice, was relieved of his duties after sending out a tweet in solidarity with the people of Palestine. Frank, a vocal supporter of Palestine, in one of his tweets, days after his unceremonious sacking, termed the Israeli atrocities against the people in Gaza as, quote, genocide. In the Canadian city of Ontario, the New Democratic Party, NDP, expelled MPP Sarah Jama from the caucus earlier this week for her statements in support of Palestinians.
Governments and institutions in Canada are trying to use their voice to wait to silence us, to silence workers, students, educators, and peace-loving people who dare to support Palestine. And to every person who's taking a risk to speak up for Palestinian dignity and safety, I see you and I hear you and I am with you. They try hard to silence us, but we know that our words are powerful and we must continue to speak up no matter the cost.
In a series of tweets, Sarah Jama called for an immediate ceasefire and de-escalation. Mahad Akil, one of the top agents in Hollywood, also had to call it quits from her role at the Creative Artists Agency, CAA, after she posted in support of Palestine. And Tanya Singh, a unionist from Minneapolis, said she had been terminated from her job in a union for anti-Semitism over her support for Palestine.
Governments across the world, in an attempt to address anti-Semitism and somehow redress the horrors of the Holocaust, are allowing Israel to get away with apartheid, ethnic cleansing, detention of children, torture, restriction of movement and other freedoms, and the illegal occupation of land. After every genocide, the world cries out, "Never again." And yet here you see another attempted genocide unfold right in front of your eyes, and you don't just watch on quietly, but actively supporting the oppressor.
Meanwhile, the crisis in Gaza has unveiled Western double standards regarding the issue of Palestinians and their cause. Western nations have tried their best to silence pro-Palestine voices. Germany, for example, has in recent weeks moved hysterically to ban pro-Palestine demonstrations altogether, smearing them as quote-unquote anti-Semitic gatherings. Berlin has violently cracked down on Palestinian activists. French Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin has declared an outright ban on all Palestine-related protests. In addition, those standing in solidarity with the Palestinian cause are also reportedly being stopped, questioned and fined. In the UK, the Rishi Sunak government has come out openly in support of the Israeli regime's genocidal campaign in the besieged Gaza Strip. Home Secretary Suella Braverman insisted that waving the Palestinian flag could amount to inciting racism or violence. At the same time, Prime Minister Sunak demanded all state buildings should display the Israeli flag. The response by the European officials to the massacre in the Gaza Strip and the subsequent intensifications of the siege and the indiscriminate bombing of civilians by Tel Aviv has laid bare the hypocrisy of the European leaders and their blatant bias towards Israel.
We know for sure that we represent the views of the majority of people in Ireland. We represent the views of our Parliament, and we genuinely believe that we represent the views of the majority of European citizens who have taken to the streets in their tens and hundreds of thousands over the past number of days, appalled by the stance of the EU so-called leaders who have been complicit in genocide and ethnic cleansing by allowing Israel to behave as it does.
Just days ago, more than 800 EU officials wrote a letter to the bloc's chief, Ursula von der Leyen, criticizing her uncontrolled support of Israel. The signatories of the letter said, "There is a seeming indifference demonstrated over the past few days by our institution towards the ongoing massacre of civilians in the Gaza Strip in disregard for human rights and international humanitarian law." The letter represents deep division within the bloc on how to approach the Israel-Gaza war.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Yani?
Bazaar.
Historically, humans lived a colourful and adventurous hunter-gatherer lifestyle. But what brought humans into the valleys and grasslands, and later into a collective society? Some argue wheat domesticated mankind, settling humans permanently next to their fields. Humans have come a long way from traditional farming. Presently, some 38% of the Earth's surface is used to cultivate crops. Technology has revolutionized agricultural production, leading to more food security worldwide.
Oh, hello there. Welcome to another edition of Bazaar. This time we will explore the agriculture industry. We shine the spotlight on the marriage between technology and science for high-yield agricultural productions. We wanted to see how the agricultural sector is developing new ways to increase the efficiency of natural resource use while also elevating the quality of cultivated food. Well, let's not waste any time. Let's walk through the fields of today's bazaar.
Our quest for answers led us to a company in Khorasan Razavi province that specializes in livestock rearing and potato cultivation. Khozai is a family business handed down to four generations over the years. It has some 2,400 hectares of farmland where saffron, Mohammadi roses, potatoes and wheat are cultivated. This company has spent years perfecting a cultivation system using its own agrotechie, enabling it to enhance the performance of mini tubers. So what is a mini tuber? They are the first generation of nuclear miniature seed potatoes. These can be engineered to have disease-free characteristics and are bred to shorten field cycles, leading to high harvest yields of healthy potatoes. The beating heart of this company is its research and development department. This is where production actually begins. This company has several varieties of potatoes in vitro tissue culture form that are subject to rigorous disease testing. This ensures the company starts cultivation with the highest quality tissue cultures. After lab tests, the plant material is transferred to hydroponic greenhouses and later taken to the field for mass production.
You might be wondering why some farmers choose hydroponic methods over others. It's a solace system where roots are kept in a dark environment saturated with an aerosol of nutrient-rich solution. This way, cultivators can observe the entire plant structure and strictly control production phases. Plus, this high-tech method gives cultivators unique insight into specific plant characteristics that can assist with field production.
As we mentioned earlier, this company also specializes in raising sheep and cows for meat and dairy production. It's interesting to know how potato production led to livestock rearing. The founder and director of the company shares his experience with us. After the mini tubes are raised in greenhouses, a portion of them is stored in refrigerated rooms for later use. Other storage facilities hold potato seeds and harvested products, which are later released into the market. It is no surprise that this company has received three consecutive national awards for being a top producer of livestock and agricultural products. Much of its success is attributed to a large amount of science and knowledge used for production. This company employs expert staff and researchers who also play a significant role in the company's dynamic progress.
36 نفر از پرسنل ما دارای مدرک تحصیلی بالای کارشناسی ارشد هستند و اینها خیلی کمک ما میکنند در پویایی این مجموعه. به همین ترتیب تمام مجموعه ها افرادی رو از ابتدا شروع کرده تربیت کردن و تحصیل کردن در این مورد و تک تک افراد از ابتدا روی رشته‌های خاص خودشون کار می‌کردن از قبل از دیپلمشون برای این کار تأهید شده بودن و تونستن دوره دکتراشون رو در رشته‌ای بگیرن که مورد نظر مجموعه بوده و موضوع گزارششون رو مجموعه براشون تعیین کرده که این گزارش رو این رشته رو بخونن.
As part of its future vision, this company is eyeing expansion. It is already working on launching a botany clinic and other food-related laboratories. This company takes a great deal of pride in its socially responsible productions. It has spent decades trying to optimize its use of natural resources and make organic and nutritious products.
The company we just mentioned is just one example of how the agricultural industry is expanding with the help of modern technology. Iran produces tons of agricultural products annually, which it also exports to destinations abroad. The food industry is also heavily dependent on this sector as it plays a critical role in the country's food security and national economy.
Iran has a total area of 165 million hectares of land. Of this amount, 50 million hectares are arable farmlands. Moreover, some 21,000 hectares are dedicated to greenhouse farming. Iran's agriculture makes up around 8% of the national GDP. Plus, it employs one-fifth of the country's entire workforce. The country's agro-food products also accounted for around 20% of the country's non-oil exports in 2020. Data from Iran's Customs Administration shows that Iran exported over $800 million worth of agricultural products from April through May this year. Additionally, figures showed over 1.7 million tons of these products were sold to foreign markets during that period. Around half of the revenue generated from exports belonged to 10 major agricultural products. Championing the top of the export list were pistachios. This was followed by watermelon and tomatoes in terms of export value. Horticulture, aquaculture, and livestock products also raked in millions in foreign exchange. Industry analysts say there has been a relative decline in exports compared to the same two-month period last year. They say more attention should be given to marketing, better packaging and transportation to boost agricultural exports. The Chamber of Commerce, Industries, Mines and Agriculture also released a report examining the relative decline in agricultural products. The report showed a less than average rainfall coupled with misuse of natural resources in farming practices are two of the major culprits of reduced production. Mining is the process of extracting valuable materials from the Earth's crust. It is one of the oldest industries and dates back to prehistoric times when people first mined flint to make tools and weapons. However, mining has come a long way from its traditional methods to incorporate advanced material science and geology. Moreover, modern mining wouldn't be the same without its heavy-duty machines to extract and haul material for processing. On the whole, this sector is one of the largest and most productive industries the world has ever known.
We are going to take a look at Iran's mining industry while shining the spotlight on zinc dust production. We wanted to see how this stuff is made and where it's used. Plus, we will explore this sector's contributions to the national economy.
To better understand the most recent developments in the mining industry, we visited Zarin Rui Caspian. It is a subsidiary of the parent company Zarin Industrial Mining Group and specializes in making zinc dust. Products at this company come in the form of bluish-gray zinc powder or granules. These products are made with specific formulations depending on their end use. In short, these items are produced when purified zinc vapors are condensed. But this requires a large amount of processing, starting with melting zinc crucibles. Next, the molten zinc is transferred to a vaporizing furnace. The vapors are then sent to a condenser to form zinc dust by circulating the gas through a cyclone cooler. Most zinc dust production plants include a vertical crucible melting and vaporizing furnace and a condenser, which operate on a fluid and continuous basis. That's why this production company works around the clock without breaks. Now you might be wondering where zinc powder is used. Due to its unique characteristics, it is a sacrificing element that helps prevent corrosion. Meaning it works well in absorbing moisture and strengthening metal surfaces against oxidation.
It is a perfect substance for coating industrial machines that withstand harsh climatic conditions.
So many processes are at work when it comes to mining. There is exploration, extraction, and refining of raw material, just to name a few. But activities don't end there. Usually, there are mega holding companies in the mining sector with several subsidiaries, such as the company we just mentioned. These subsidiaries are essential in expanding and completing mining-based products' supply chains.
An asset to corporations is their research and development departments. This is because they carry out activities leading to technological development. That is to say, they develop new services or products and improve existing ones while elevating the company's industrial standing. This department also performs critical quality control checks where standards are also implemented. And indeed, standards are everything, especially for foreign trade. One of this company's competitive advantages is its high purity products based on national and international needs. This company also purchases most of its raw materials from domestic suppliers. Among its services, it can formulate zinc powders based on special orders from customers. It also provides its customers flexible delivery, whether by sea, air, or ground. This producer has never stopped looking to the future. It plans to increase its current market share and create new products that can be used in other down-the-line industries. This company has achieved many successes despite being relatively recently established. But that's not to say it has not faced many challenges along the way. One such challenge has been maintaining its machines, which sometimes require spare parts for repairs.
In case you didn't know, and most don't actually, the country is home to more than 7% of global mineral reserves. That's significant. With over 80 different types of minerals, Iran is one of the top 10 mineral-rich countries globally. In total, the country has about 60 billion tons of proven mineral reserves, making it one of the most important mineral producers in the world.
The mining ministry says the total production value in this sector is over $700 billion. This value has not been unnoticed by the government, which has been seriously pursuing several programs promoting the mining sector. Despite its enormous riches, Iran has yet to unlock its full potential as this key sector is still struggling to operate at full capacity. There are several reasons for this. One is a lack of necessary machinery and equipment for expanding this industry. So the government is focusing on geological exploration, extraction, and research of new products as part of areas for development. Another one of the government's programs to increase production is to increase mineral extraction. So organizations have embarked on reviving idle mines. Out of 10,000 mines in the country, around 4,000 of them are idle. It's noteworthy that over the last 2 years, some 500 small-scale idle mines have been brought back to life. That's based on the Iranian Mines and Mining Industries Development and Renovation Organization. One of the benefits of the ongoing revival plan has been the rise in nationwide employment. Presently, well over 100,000 miners are at work in the sector.
Mining in Iran has more work to be done, and it's still under development. Still, there are plenty of doers in this country and plenty more waiting for further investment opportunities. Iran's productions by far outweigh its domestic use, leaving lots of room for mineral exports. The industry is export-oriented, as a matter of fact.
Figures from Iran's Trade Promotion Organization show a record high of nearly $12 billion worth of minerals and mining products were exported last year. This means there was roughly an 80% increase in exports year on year. Championing the export list in terms of value were steel ingots and related products, copper, aluminium, zinc, and iron. This is a pretty big growth spurt, actually,
But government officials say export figures could be much higher if raw materials and other mining products could be further developed with added value. So, efforts have been placed on encouraging research and production in knowledge-based firms to increase specialized products in the market. And here is where knowledge-based companies play a big role. The current Iranian calendar year's slogan was knowledge-based production and job creation. The title was given by the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. The goal is to promote and increase support for companies that engineer and produce advanced products that contribute to the economy.
Well, it's that time of the show where I should step aside for several minutes because my good friend and colleague is actually out there on the field. So, let's see that report.
In the modern world today, both industrialized and developing countries have modern installations capable of highly efficient fabric production. In addition to mechanical improvements in yarn and fabric manufacture, there have been rapid advances in the development of new fibers, processes to improve textile characteristics, and testing methods allowing greater quality control. Today, we visited Aram Takmil Teyfe Faro's company, active in the textile industry in Iran. In this company, there are various activities such as processes of weaving, dyeing, and finishing, and printing of different types of textiles while employing the strongest technical staff as well as modern European dyeing and finishing machines to finally meet customer satisfaction with quality products and innovations. Iran's textile industry has a capacity to produce a wide variety of products suitable for different market segments, both within Iran and across the world. Over the past years, close to 30,000 tons of different types of textile were imported. Presently, however, there are 78 textile factories active in the country, producing 90 million square meters of different kinds of fabric every year. Iran's Development Plan Vision 2025 has identified textile and clothing as one of the potential industries for expansion. The plan basically emphasizes on the need for technological advancements and improvement in productivity.
Many thanks for that awesome adventure, as always. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition. I'm Samson Sees. Sees you soon.
On August 25, 1941, Britain and the Soviet Union invaded Iran. The occupation secured the Allies' continued access both to the Iranian oil fields and to the so-called Persian Corridor, the Allies' military supply line from the Persian Gulf through Iran and into the Soviet Union, which was under heavy attack by Nazi Germany. Although the Treaty of Alliance between the British and Soviet governments promised to respect the territorial integrity, the invasion and subsequent occupation of neutral Iran had undeniable catastrophic impacts on the country. The 1940 was a crucial year for Britain. The Battle of Britain raged for months in the skies of Britain. British tanks went head-to-head with German Rommel tanks in North Africa, and the Royal Navy fought the Italians for control of the Mediterranean. Their planes, tanks, and ships all needed vast quantities of oil to keep running, and much of that oil came from Iran, especially from the Abadan refinery. So losing the refinery would be disastrous for the British. On the other hand, Reza Shah Pahlavi's reliance on German technology for his so-called development plans had worried the Allies, who feared the Germans might make Iran a base for operations against the Soviet Union. Although the Shah maintained the country's neutrality during World War II, the British refused to accept this and accused the Shah of supporting the Nazis. Iran reaffirmed its neutrality, but the writing was on the wall for invasion, which came after Hitler's forces managed to roll into the Soviet Union on June 22, 1941. They quickly captured their objectives and pushed deep into the USSR, threatening the Caucasus. It was almost a certainty that if the Reich succeeded and the Germans occupied the Caucasus and then pushed on to Iran and the Persian Gulf, they would then outflank the British positions in the Middle East. But even worse, the Germans had cut off the USSR's key ports. Stalin desperately needed military supplies from Britain and the USA to maintain the fight against the Axis. Without the ports, the best way to get these supplies was via the Trans-Iranian Railway, part of the Persian Corridor, which connected the Persian Gulf to the Caspian Sea. In July 1941, British and Soviet diplomats demanded the Shah boot out any Germans living in the country, but he refused. On August 17th, another demand to expel all Germans was issued to the Shah. He rejected this one too. 1 week later, the tanks rolled in. Soviet field armies marched to the north of the country as hundreds of Soviet bombers thundered in the skies above. The north of Iran was lost to the Soviets on August 26th. At the same time, British forces, which were mostly Indians, attacked in the south. The Royal Air Force then flew in and bombed Tehran and Qazvin. They were aimed for military targets. The bombing in 1941 was much more miss than hit. Consequently, several hundred civilians were killed. British paratroopers secured the Abadan refinery and then engaged Iranian forces. By August 26th, the British had captured the entire region. While Tehran shuddered from explosions of both British and Soviet bombs, Reza Shah demanded the ambassadors of the invaders explain themselves. Both said it was because of German residents. When the Shah asked if they would stop after he kicked the Germans out, they didn't answer. On August 27th, the British advanced to Ahvaz. From there, they planned to drive north, captured Qazvin, and linked up with the Soviets. By August 28th, the Iranian situation was hopeless. The Soviets threatened to completely flatten Tehran with bombs, and the British blockade was already causing food shortages. On the 29th, 4 days after the invasion began, the Shah ordered a ceasefire. Continued resistance was hopeless in the face of combined Soviet and British firepower. The Persian corridor became the primary mode for supplies to reach the Soviet Union. The Anglo-Soviet invasion brought about seismic changes, one of them Reza Shah's abdication, although the Iranians' reactions were mixed. They were happy to see the end of Reza Shah's tyranny, but at the same time, they were fearful of an indefinite future. In the dethroned Shah's place came his 21-year-old son, Mohammad Reza Shah, who had until then been shut up in a Swiss boarding school, or else cocooned at court, was not prepared for rule, making him a puppet manipulated by Western powers for almost four decades. During the 3 years of occupation, Joseph Stalin expanded Soviet political influence in Azerbaijan and Iranian Kurdistan in northwestern Iran, as well as in Iran, founding the Communist Tudeh Party of Iran, totally at the service of their Soviet masters. When the deadline for withdrawal arrived on the 2nd of March 1942, 6 months after the end of the World War, Moscow refused, justifying that it had to remain in Iran to counter threats to Soviet security. Soviet troops did not withdraw from Iran until 1946, following Iran's official complaint to the newly formed United Nations Security Council, which became the first complaint filed by the country in the UN's history, and a test for the UN's effectiveness in resolving global issues in the aftermath of the war. However, the UN Security Council took no direct steps to pressure the Soviets to withdraw. There are many takeaways from the Anglo-Soviet invasion of Iran. For example, public resistance against foreign invaders was not significant. Like in the case of the US-led invasion of Iraq, people were not motivated enough to sacrifice their lives for the sake of a tyrannical system. Or, for example, Reza Shah's lack of deep understanding of international relations and his blind sympathy for Nazi Germany cost him and the country dearly. But perhaps the most important lesson the nation learned was the unreliability of the West. Iranian neutrality was ignored, and the country lost its independence to occupying forces. The British and Soviet authorities dominated the use of major roadways and the Trans-Iranian Railroad for their own purposes, and deployed Iranian manpower and equipment for the war effort. With few resources left for farming, combined with a bad harvest in 1942 and an enormous influx of European refugees, famine spread and many people died. Instability within the political and social arenas grew and the economy suffered. With this humiliation, the Iranian people realized that the West doesn't care about neutrality if that neutrality is not going to serve their interests. All these bitter lessons have left their residue on the collective unconsciousness of the Iranian nation and delineated the way of their interaction with the Western world in the years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines this hour. Defying international calls, Israel launches fresh strikes on Gaza, raising the Palestinian fatalities to over 10,500, most of them women and children. During his visit to Tajikistan, Iran's President Raisi slams the West's support for the Israeli regime's brutalities against Palestinians in Gaza.